We're going to approach this Sabbath a little differently than what we've done here recently. So what I want to do is I want to go ahead and I want to read to you from the introduction of the preface from the Compendium of World History, which Dr. Hay wrote years ago. Having to do with how historians record things, and it is also true on how religionists present doctrines. Very true. So let me read a couple pages out of this. This is real interesting. By what authority have historians left God and the Bible out of history? And we could ask the same thing concerning doctrine. By what authority have theologians left God and truth out of Bible study? This question may come as a surprise. Many are unaware that a radically new interpretation of history is being taught in schools and colleges today. And this statement is even more so true today than when he wrote this some 20 years ago. The Constitution is really not being taught in the schools. How many remember the flap, must have been 3 years ago, when there was this book, the history book, that was going to be accepted by the California schools, but in it talked about quoting someone in the 1800s writing about a quotation about blacks and saying that they were like little pickaninnies. Remember that? Okay. And the honorable, question mark, Willie Brown got all upset, got it all canceled. That book, outside of that one quotation we sent away for it, is one of the best, absolutely best books on the Constitution that you would ever want. And the way that they're going to change the Constitution, which they're going to do, sooner or later they'll have a constitutional convention. They're only two states away from ratifying it, and then there's an argument if they vote for it, if a state votes for it, and then rescinds the vote for it, that they can't take away their yes vote at any time. So they may force that upon them. And the way that they're going to get a new constitution in, and you wait and see, there will be, is that they are changing the way that history is taught. See, they don't teach that the Puritans never observed Christmas. They don't teach that the Puritans, when they first came here, were Seventh-day Sabbath keepers. And there's so much history that is lost. Okay? Is it a history of the world in which, it is a history rather, of the world in which God and the supernatural are rejected, but now they're bringing back supernatural. How are they bringing back supernatural? By this paraphenomenal psychology, which is getting into demonism and witchcraft. So you get God out, and then you bring in Satan. It's always going to happen. It's impossible to believe both this history and the Bible. Both cannot be right. The modern interpretation of history stands in open conflict with scriptures. How did this conflict arise? When did history forget God and become confused? Why are historians so sharply divided into opposing schools over the chronological events of the ancient world? And I'm not going to get into how bad and how silly that carbon dating and argon dating is, and what would happen if they would do it honestly. They would have to admit that what they're saying is a lie. You know, for example, this Professor Leakey, he was quite a guy. He stumbled over it looked like a skull head, the top of a skull, you know, and he said, oh boy, this thing is millions and millions and millions of years old. Upon a finer scrutiny of it, it turned out to be an elephant's kneecap. Okay. A radical new view. What many do not realize is that the modern worldview of history without God is a radically new interpretation of human experiences. Almost no one today, it seems, has ever questioned whether this new interpretation is right. It is merely assumed to be right. And I might mention that if you have an opportunity to get... This new interpretation has never been questioned whether it's right. It's merely assumed to be right. Now, if you have the opportunity, by all means, see if you can get a full set of McGuffey readers. Have you ever seen McGuffey readers? We have a full set at home. I'll see if I can remember to bring it next time I come. He has one section on the Sabbath that will absolutely blow your mind. He says that any nation that does away with the Sabbath, and in his mind that was Sunday, loses contact with God, and when you lose contact with God, that nation goes into corruption. Absolutely true. Okay? Students in particular and the public in general have been led to believe that archaeologists, historians, scientists, and theologians live with full assurance and an absolute conviction that this new interpretation of history without God is correct. Nothing could be further from the truth. One would be shocked to hear the candid admissions and private confessions of learned scholars. These men appear to write and speak with confidence. They are assumed to know the answers to history's greatest questions. How did man originate? Why is man here? Where is man going? And no one can tell you that yet. And just as an aside, when Satan told Adam and Eve if they ate of this tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they would become like God. Well, I think in order for them to understand that statement, God must have discussed with them his plan for what he was going to do. Now, that's just a thought, you know, think on that. That's no doctrine, but I'm saying, here's a thought. If it might fit into that, then it might be worth considering when we study it. But if it doesn't, then we'll cast it out. Okay? Well, what do they know? They have no scientific way of discovering the answers. They're only guessing. One famous historian, Hendrik von Loon, dared to confess this in his book, The Story of Mankind. Here are his candid words. We live under the shadow of a giant question mark. What are we? Where did we come from? Whither, or that is, where are we bound? His answer? We still know very little, but we have reached the point where, with a fair degree of accuracy, we can guess at many things. Now, that's a shocking quote and a statement. However, I want you to understand how much that has been done in this Passover thing and the Pentecost thing. How much is guessing because they start out with the wrong basis to begin with. Astounding but true, yet these guesses are masquerading today as authoritative interpretations of history. Casual readers would be shocked to learn how history books are prepared. It is usually assumed that history is solely a matter of collecting factual material, judiciously evaluating, and recording it for posterity. Nothing could be further from the truth, warned C. Ram, in the book called The Secret of the Hittites. A historian is not a scribe, but a judge of the evidence that is brought before him. Now, notice this in newspaper writing. This applies also to newspaper articles that are written. The writer is not presenting the facts. He is presenting his biased view of the facts. Remember, that is the way that it is. In everything. Would you get, we'll just use an example here since it's baseball season. We now have the Oakland A's who are in first place and it looks like that they're going to absolutely wipe out the rest of the league. We're told that their greatest challenger, what is that? The Kansas City Royals, that if in order for them to tie with the A's at the end of the season, 142 games from now, they would have to go 21 games over 500 ball, and the A's would only have to play 500 ball, that is win 71 and lose 71 to tie for the final championship of the, what is that, American League West, yes. Okay? Now, on the other hand, the Giants are at the bottom, they're at the cellar, and they were first place last year. Question, would you get an A's fan to accurately portray the Giants? Would you get a Giants fan to accurately portray the A's, especially considering how that they are 17-2 of the last 19 games that they have played? No. Could you get a Republican to accurately, fairly give a historical count or writing about the Democrats? How about the Democrats, the Republicans? No. Okay? So you need to keep that in mind. He is a judge of the evidence brought before him. He is his own final authority. He is not judged by, but sits in judgment of history. Whatever evidence does not conform to the commonly accepted beliefs of the age or community in which he lives, he summarily rejects it. Now let me read that statement again. Whatever evidence does not conform to the commonly accepted beliefs of the age or community in which he lives, he summarily rejects it. That's exactly what happens. History, in other words, is based only on that part of evidence which agrees with the prevailing opinions of the society in which the historian lives. Now, if those are not profound words, I don't know what are. These may be shocking evaluations, but they are true. World history texts prove it. Historians admit it. The selection, quote now, from the same writer, the selection of sources still rests upon the discretion of the individual historian. When he chooses as relevant, what he chooses rather as relevant, depends upon his conception of the period he is studying. Now this is literally true. I find this all the time in doing real estate and real estate loans. People buying real estate or getting loans before they understand the process only reveal the good side. That's why they're credit reports, because that reveals the not so good side, if it's not so good. Okay? So you have the same thing. This is part of human nature. I remember one time, my sister and I, Marilyn, we lived in a downstairs apartment. The manager lived right above us. And we had one knockdown drag out of a fight. And we were shouting and yelling and screaming. And she was crying. And she was chasing me around the apartment with a broom, and I was doing something else. And all of a sudden, came the knock, knock, knock on the door. What happened? Dead silence. So what do? You dry your tears, you know, and try and look as refreshed as you can. Knock, 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 knock again. How long can you delay them? Well, you can't delay them too long, okay? So you go open the door, and guess who's standing at the door? The manager from upstairs. And he said, is everything all right? Is there anything wrong? Oh, Everything's just fine. Eh? So it's part of the way that we function. I have yet, in visiting anyone, if you had a fight just before I come, open the door and say, guess what, we had the most miserable knockdown fight just before you came? No way. Okay? What he chooses as relevant depends upon his conception of the period he is studying or the story he is telling. Okay? In this, the historian is limited by his own temperament and guided by the spirit of his age. Is there any wonder what different nations and peoples, is there any wonder that different nations and peoples have divergent histories of the same event? Not without bias. Take an example of the history of World War II. Communist historians write only those facts about the war that can be shaped to suit the aims of the Communist Party. And one thing they forgot to tell all the Soviet people was all the aid that the Americans gave them. Japanese historians view the episode at Pearl Harbor quite differently from Americans. Even in America, there are two or more versions about the responsibility for the Pearl Harbor incident, depending upon the political party with which one is affiliated. Today, many German historians are united in a conspiracy to hide the truth about the Hitler regime from the younger generation. The Nazi period is glossed over almost as if it did not exist. And how did historians handle the events of the First World War? In the same manner. French historians gave an account of the Versailles Treaty at the end of the war, which was dramatically opposed to the German version. Each nation chose to accept only those facts which led to the historical support of its selfish motives. Sounds a little bit like Vietnam, doesn't it? Sounds a little bit like the Korean War. The reconstruction and interpretation of history to suit political, social, economic, religious, or racial prejudice is a practice of scientific historians of all nations. Much of this prejudice the writers themselves are unaware of. It is so natural to human nature that they are often convinced that their own prejudices do not exist. You will never get anyone to admit that he or she has prejudices. Do you have prejudices? You don't know? I do. I'm totally prejudiced for God's way. That makes me prejudiced. Okay? The suppression of part of the truth is the primary reason the world has never learned the lessons of history. The secondary reason, of course, is that most individuals do not want to believe the truth of history even when it is told them. A case history. In a remarkable episode which occurred in America in 1954 when the High Court of the Land was confronted with a major social issue, a noted historian had become involved in the legal aspects of the case. Here's what happened in his own words as he told to fellow historians. The problem we faced was not the historian's discovery of truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. The problem instead was the formulation of an adequate gloss. Now that's what we're dealing with this doctrine of Pentecost written by William F. Dankenbrink. We are not concerned in this paper with the whole truth, the truth, and nothing but the truth as presented in the scriptures. We are confronted with a preconceived notion of doctrine whereby the paper is set out then to justify that preconceived notion. And of course, that's violating several rules of Bible study. It was not that we were engaged in formulating lies. There was nothing as crude and naive as that, but we were using facts, emphasizing facts, bearing down on facts, sliding off facts, quietly ignoring facts, and above all, interpreting facts in a way to get by. And we're going to see that exact same thing here. The evidence, then, he goes on to say that the evidence accepted in the 1954 case was really a reinterpretation of history to justify the Supreme Court in granting that judgment that they did. Was that not done? Was that not done with Roe versus Wade for abortion? They selected one case, they bore down on facts, they eased up on facts, they changed facts, they maneuvered it so they developed a case so that they would get abortion as the law of the land. It's exactly what happened. Precisely what happened. I think when the resurrection comes, and we're going to know the real truth of history, we are going to be absolutely amazed. Now, let's take this paper with what I just read in mind. Let's take the paper, what is the correct day to observe Pentecost? Now, notice the very first line at the top of the page. It says, astounding new truth. Now, what is astounding new truth? Well, I would say it would be astounding new truth if it were something like they just claimed that they did this week. How many read in the paper that for the very first time that they were able to take human brain cells and to cause them to replicate in the test tube? That is astounding new truth. Never been done before. Never been done before. And hey, this is a great advance and so forth. I won't get into that. But when you say astounding new truth, now we're going to have to, in this paper, see something which has never been before. Is that correct? Otherwise, it is not new truth. Okay, is he headlining his paper? Answer, yes, through sensationalism. Okay, what is the correct date to observe Pentecost? We'll read through several of the first paragraphs here, and then we'll get in on the inside part of it, and I'll just cover certain sections of it. I don't want to go through this one word for word like I did the other one. Just want to point out some very important facts. Okay, what is the correct method to count or calculate the day of Pentecost? From just which Sabbath are we to count 50 days? The Worldwide Church of God has been in shocking error on this matter. Here, for the first time revealed, is the astounding proof. All right, now, whenever someone says for the first time revealed, and it has been there before, it is not the first time revealed, right? And when they say it is the truth, it should be the truth rather than their interpretation of the evidence. Now you know why I went through so thoroughly, we went over this calendar thing so thoroughly, so that you really understood what it was. Okay? Amazing but true. Once human beings begin a pattern of error, it's exceedingly difficult to correct the error and to come to the truth. Nevertheless, Herbert W. Armstrong wrote several years ago, "We are all human. We are all fallible. I have been wrong. I've made mistakes. The same is true of all of those God is using in his work." Then he goes on, God says, prove all things, so forth, so on. Let's come down here to the paragraph which begins with recently. Okay? Recently, new evidence has come to my attention that proves beyond any doubt that the Church of God has still been observing the day of Pentecost on the wrong day. Now, new evidence would constitute what? Something which has never been discovered before. Something which had never been written before. Something which no one had ever observed before, correct? All right, we'll see. Is that what he presented? No, not in the slightest. Now, let's go to page number 2. It says, nevertheless, the facts prove that beyond any shadow of doubt, the Church of God has been in error on the day of Pentecost from the time the work began in 1934 until 1987, or over 50 years. Let me insert one little bit of historical truth, which many people do not know. When Herbert Armstrong first began keeping Pentecost, way back when, guess which day he observed it on? When he first, the very first Pentecost that Herbert Armstrong and his little group kept was the Jewish day, the 6th of Sivan. So that statement is incorrect. See, he doesn't know what he's writing about. You have to be careful when you make statements like that. Okay? Now, I want to point something out that is clear. Bill Dankenbrink is a very prolific and productive writer. He can write. But this kind of thinking and this kind of sensationalism caused problems with Worldwide. When he was a writer there, he was a prolific writer for them, and he was a cause of the problems in Worldwide because of his writings. And now he has no one to govern or check what he does, and obviously we end up with things like this. Okay? Page number 3. At the bottom, under the subheading, which Sabbath do we count from? Some believe that the Sabbath intended is the regular weekly Sabbath. However, others believe that the Sabbath in question is plainly the first high holy day Sabbath of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In verse 7 of this chapter, God plainly shows that the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread was ordained as a Sabbath. As we showed last week, he did not. He said it was a holy convocation. No servile work was to be done therein. It was to be a holy convocation. Immediately following this commandment, God introduces the offering of the sheaf of the first fruits following verse 10. No, it doesn't immediately follow that because you have day 7 in between the first day and verse 10, as we pointed out last week. Okay? Go to page 4. Right on the second line, right after Leviticus 23:11, beginning with the sentence following that, it is obvious that the context itself proves that this Sabbath is the first holy day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Let's go to Leviticus 23 just to refresh our memory, so we'll have it right here on this tape while we're recording it. Now, let me read that statement again. It is obvious that the context itself proves that this Sabbath is the first holy day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. Now, if you read beginning verse 7, down to verse 11, there is nothing which says that it is, or proves that it's obvious that it is the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. If it were meant to be a holy day, the only obvious conclusion you can come from any context is it would have to be the seventh day, the last holy day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread. But you will notice very carefully in verse 11, it says, and he shall wave the sheaf before the Lord to be accepted for you on the morrow after the Sabbath, the priest shall wave it. If God intended it to be the first holy day, what would we find here? And you shall wave the sheaf on the day after the first holy day. Okay? Now, not this time, but next time I'm going to show you that the Septuagint indeed says that, but then there's little telltale evidence that they were fiddling with the texts, because the Hebrew does not say or refer to a holy day at all, but a Sabbath, and that is universally translated Sabbath throughout the entire Bible, not week. Okay, let's go back here. Continuing, he says, otherwise, confusion would have set in if God meant the regular weekly Sabbath and thus changed the thought. He would have said weekly Sabbath. Well, that's exactly what God said. He said Shabbat. Okay? This is page 4 now. In order to distinguish it from the annual Sabbath which he had just ordained in verse 7 of this chapter. So what do we find? We find his reasoning then is not following along correctly. Does everybody have it where we are now? Everybody in the same place? Okay. I'll let you read the rest of it. Let's come down to the, right under the next subheading, how did the Pharisees count it? In the days of Christ, there were two leading religious sects in Israel, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees were very conservative in doctrine, whereas the Sadducees became very liberal. Now notice immediately what are the two buzzwords from modern reporting that we pick up here. Okay. Yes, we're going to have to back up because the question came up. But what I want to do is I want to also show you how to be aware of the prejudices of the writer and what the writer is trying to do. We have two buzzwords here. Conservative, which if you believe in the Bible fundamentally is good, right? Versus liberal, which if you believe in the Bible fundamentally is bad and evil. Brethren, grace is liberal. You think about that. Now let's go back up to the first full paragraph on page 4, because he makes an error here. Thanks for bringing it to my attention. Appreciate that. If I slip up, let me know. Notice now the story flow and sequence of events during this pivotal springtime festival of 7 days. First, the Passover was observed on the evening of the 14th of Nisan, symbolizing Jesus Christ, our Passover lamb. Now, please understand, to observe the Passover is not just the killing. It's the killing, it is the cooking, it is the eating, when it referred when they had the lamb. Continuing now. Then the first day of unleavened bread was observed as an annual Sabbath with a holy meeting. Then the following day is an integral part of the spring festival. On the morrow after that Sabbath, the very next morning, the wave sheaf offering was performed by the priest. This event was an integral part of the spring festival. It was not delayed until the morrow after the weekly Sabbath. Well, you see, as we pointed out last week, there are times when that occurs. Okay? So his statement is incorrect. Okay? If the weekly Sabbath was the same as the first and last holy days of unleavened bread, by coincidence then, those who claim it is the correct day claim the wave sheaf offering then came after the 7-day festival. Let me clarify it. If you have a situation where the first holy day is on a Sunday, You obviously then have the Passover on the 14th, but you see you have a problem if you believe in the 15th Passover. Because you have no day after the Sabbath. Okay? But if there's a 14th Passover, this is another proof that the Passover is on the 14th, not the 15th. Because whenever you have 8 days, you are always guaranteed that there is a Sabbath during the Feast of Unleavened Bread and Passover, correct? So what you do, Passover then becomes the Sabbath, the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, being a Sunday, also becomes a wave sheaf offering day because it is to be done during the days of unleavened bread and not outside of the days of unleavened bread. Okay, now, this also shows another thing. This is why God did not have the crucifixion fall in a year when the Passover was on a Sabbath. Because Jesus would not have been in the grave 3 days and three nights. Okay? Now, so then you see what we have done. We have seen in this then, his thinking is geared, since he believes in a 15th Passover, his thinking is geared to where he does not count that Sabbath where there is a Passover as the regular weekly Sabbath during the Passover and days of unleavened bread, right? Because he would have the Passover the next day. So you see, when you go to a 15th Passover and you stand by that, then you have to make other changes and adjustments to make things work. You know, it's like a con man who starts out with one lie. He's got to live a lie. He's got to support lies. He has to manufacture lies. Watch sometimes this new Mission Impossible. It's interesting and it's clever, but whatever they do is based upon deception, to deliberately deceive, and they must construct and reconstruct everything to fit the scenario. So that's what he has to do here in order to justify now his 15th Passover. He's got to come back with this kind of statement. Okay, let's continue on. Now let's come down, let's finish this here, and let's come down again to how did the Pharisees count it? In the days of Christ, there were two leading religious sects in Israel, the Pharisees and the Sadducees. The Pharisees were very conservative in doctrine, whereas the Sadducees became very liberal. The difference between them were very great. The church historian Luke wrote, quote, "For the Sadducees say there is no resurrection, neither angel nor spirit. But the Pharisees confess both," Acts 23:8. Jesus himself had to deal with a question posed to him by the Sadducees, which say that there is no resurrection. The Pharisees later heard how he had put the Sadducees to silence. I want to ask you some questions. Look at that paragraph we just read. How many scriptures are quoted? 1, 2, 3, actually 2 and part of 1. Okay? Should you make any doctrinal conclusions based upon 2.5 partial scriptures? Notice the next sentence at the beginning of the paragraph. It should be obvious that neither Christ nor the apostles went along with the Sadducees in their doctrines. A great leap of interpretation, right? Where is it obvious? Now, we read some time ago, I think it is in Matthew 16. Let's pause and go there. Matthew 16, I'll let you read through the whole first part of it, beginning at verse 1, but come down to verse 11. How is it that you did not understand that which I spoke of? I spoke it not to you concerning bread, that you should beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. Both were wrong. Okay? Then understood they how he had bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees, whose doctrine what? Comes first. A little different than what he's trying to present, right? And the Sadducees. Now, let's go back and read his paper here. It should be obvious that neither Christ nor the apostles went along with the Sadducees in their doctrines. In fact, when Paul defended himself before a court of Pharisees and Sadducees, he claimed boldly, "Men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee, and of the hope of the resurrection, and of the hope and the resurrection of the dead, am I called into question." Now, did he do that because he was still a Pharisee? Or did he do it as a part of his own defense in front of them? Paul himself had been a Pharisee all of his life until his conversion. The Sadducees had gone very far astray in doctrine, but the Pharisees were very conservative guardians of the law and traditions of the fathers. Galatians 1, 13 and 14. What is missing? The Pharisees had gone very far astray in doctrine. The Sadducees had gone very far astray in doctrine. What is missing? Proof. No proof. It is a statement. See, he is bearing down on a fact, correct? He is easing up on a fact. We'll see here in just a minute. Notice the conclusion that it is coming to now. Okay? We'll get to the thing about Paul and the Pharisees. We'll get to that. We're going to leave no stone unturned. We're not going to take giant leaps of creative doctrinal generation as Mr. Dankenbrink has done here. Let's go on now, continuing on page 5. Jesus said of the Pharisees, "The scribes and the Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." Jesus himself, therefore, acknowledged the authority of the Pharisees as holding authority from God. Although they were abusing and misusing it. He said to his disciples, "All therefore, whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do." Now, let's go to Matthew 23. You can check this out in a New American Standard Version, if you would like. Matthew 23. It seems rather strange that Jesus would so roundly condemn the Pharisees. Oh, forgot one thing. Who'd we leave out? The scribes. What about the scribes? Okay? And who is placed before the Pharisees? The scribes. He says nothing about the authority of the scribes. In his paper. And Jesus spoke to the multitude and his disciples, saying, "The scribes and Pharisees sit in Moses' seat." Now, verse 2 is translated in the New American Translation, "have seated themselves in Moses' seat," which is borne out by the Greek. They usurped that authority. Why? Who were the Pharisees? Most of them, let's ask a question. Paul was a Pharisee, correct? Wasn't he? What did he claim himself to be as to what tribe he came from? Benjamin. Of the Hebrew of Hebrew and Israelite of Israelites of the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin was not of the tribe of Levi, correct? Only the Levites could properly sit in Moses' seat. The Pharisees and the scribes who were not of Levite or Levitical blood placed themselves, usurped the authority and sat in Moses' seat. But Jesus said, verse 3, all therefore whatsoever they bid you observe, that observe and do. And that can only refer to just the reading of the scriptures of what God says. Couldn't refer to anything else, as we covered before, because he condemned all of their all